Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we watch and read and listen to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On today's show, we go far, far away with Matt Damon in The Martian. He grows his own food. He fixes his own injuries. But is this a trip worth taking? Then we'll look past this movie about how a professional gets things done to other how it's done stories from all kinds of fields. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Be sure to check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Every week, Jesse interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have an astronaut at work and all kinds of other trained professionals coming up. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our space movie correspondent, Chris Klimek. Chris, when you're not talking about astronauts and space peril here in this room, what do you do?
I'm an editor at Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine and Pop Culture Happy Hour's Ronda Rousey Roadhouse Remake consultant.
That too. Well, The Martian is an adaptation of Andy Weir's novel, which, by the way, Glenn has spoken about on this show, I think, and I have spoken about on this show, and Chris has spoken about on this show in the past.
Yeah, what you been doing, Stephen?
Yeah, I was going to say, not reading this.
Yeah,
this
for real. Here. So it's an adaptation of this novel about an astronaut accidentally left behind during an emergency evacuation of his manned Mars mission. Short of food, water, air, and just about everything else, and not in contact with NASA, he has to stay alive until he can figure out how to get a rescue. The film was adapted by Drew Goddard, who you know from lots of great things like Buffy and Cabin in the Woods, and directed by Ridley Scott, who I think Chris
Never
can confirm has made space movies now and then.
Well, what I said when I reviewed this for you is that this feels sort of like the rebuttal to Alien. You know, Alien is the most cynical, kind of bummed out space movie ever.
It made it look like this thing
that corporations would control and that would be used to destructive ends, and that it would be an awful, soul-crushing job to have. These truck drivers aboard the Nostromo, their lives don't seem that great even before they pick up this hostile organism.
Right.
And everything about The Martian, from its visual look to its, you know, all of its thematic concerns to the way that the characters treat one another, is just 180 degrees removed from that. You know, everybody is committed. Everyone seems to get along. Even though it depicts a desperate survival scenario, it is a deeply optimistic, can-do, rah-rah-rah kind of movie. And I don't think that's a fault. So I almost wonder if Ridley Scott found the script and was kind of deliberately thinking, you know, maybe I want to revisit this subject in a more favorable light, more optimistic light.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, what did you think about this movie? I know you were a fan of the book.
Sure, sure. It's lots of fun. It looks great. It's a good time at the movies. It captures the tone of the book very well, which is, you know, this character, Mark Watney, is affable. He's likable. He's kind of an aw-shucks, self-deprecating person, and Damon does a good job with it. The author of the book, the maker of the film, is so determined that he is ingratiating that occasionally, frankly, he grates a little bit on you. This film's refusal to engage with some of the darker elements that might creep into something like this, with real darkness, despair, fear, anything like that, refusing to admit it. It is a very deliberate choice to keep it fun, to keep it tense and light. As I kind of felt about the book, too, it does thin out this experience a little bit. I'm comparing it to my reaction in his situation, which would be, and I looked at my watch, 6 minutes into this experience, I would have taken off my helmet and taken a deep lungful of that clean Mars air. I would go total recall on this and just totally give up.
Yeah, but the deaths in Total Recall are so great with
that's
the bulging
true.
Eyes.
Yeah, I should mention, as you're talking about this, there's an interview at the website HitFix where they talk to Andy Weir about the fact that the movie is missing, actually, and I won't reveal what it is, but the movie is missing a major dose of darkness that is introduced into the story as a sort of a recognition of the fact that just outside the boundaries of this affable guy and his nice sense of humor lies this very grim calculus about what's going to happen if anything goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's all sort of taken out of the book. So I think even more than the book, it avoids kind of touching those elements.
Right. I think it's important to say, though, that deliberate choice about the tone, that is Andy Weir's choice. That's not Drew Goddard. That's not Ridley Scott. That is very accurately reflective of
right.
the book.
I agree with that. But I'm just saying that even where the book flirts with those things,
yeah.
those things aren't in the movie.
And those things that are cheesy in the book are cheesy in the film. There's a lot of people looking worried. There's a lot of what I call Cold Mountain Syndrome, where every bit character is not a... When they come onto screen, it's not, oh, a new character. You think, oh, a star playing that
right.
character.
See also so Black Mass. See
yes,
also Everest. There's a lot of this in the fall.
It's great seeing Donald Glover on screen, but it's Donald Glover on screen. It's not the character. So there is a critique to be made of this film, which you touched upon, Chris. I mean, the guy I saw it with, my husband, kept looking at me, rolling his eyes and going, seriously? Thinking that it was too rah-rah America. I mansplained to him that it was actually... rah-rah NASA, technically, rah-rah engineering, technically. And there's a difference between plausible and believable. And everything in this book, we haven't had the think piece by Neil deGrasse Tyson yet, where he comes out and goes, well, actually.
No, he's been tweeting mostly positive things.
Absolutely. Because this science, this whole book, which was basically the most page-turning physics to word problem I have ever read, all that science has been vetted. So when you get to this movie, it's all been vetted. But it was interesting to me that somebody who hadn't read the book, he didn't buy it. He didn't buy a lot of this science. He thought it was too wrapped up in sort of swooning, yay America, yay NASA kind of stuff.
All right. How about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I think more than yay America, it's yay science.
Yeah.
And it's yay problem solving. I mean, I'm like the umpty quadrillionth person to say that this is a movie about solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
And every step of the way, as a new problem is introduced, you get a sense of how it's solved. And that's essentially what is keeping the plot moving is a string of problems that need to be solved. I thought so much better in this movie than a similar situation did in Gravity, which, you know, is a very beloved movie,
right.
which to me was this kind of almost oppressive string of space peril. This gives its story more room to breathe. It still has some of the big beats and some of the big emotional stuff. And you have, you know, a certain amount of like exposition by television reporter and like you have these touches of a fairly conventional story. But to me, I found it so winning throughout, and I loved the way that this movie paused to be funny and paused to reflect and didn't need constant action to be gripping. I went with my kids, who were 14 and 11, and they were pretty well mesmerized through the whole thing. And they're not necessarily like, I don't take them to the Air and Space Museum every weekend. They're not like super duper sciencey
right,
kids, but they were really swept up in really just this very nicely, tightly constructed story about all these problems that the guy faces, all of which are leavened with humor at just the right time.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's interesting about you raising the point that it's not the kind of endless rounds of space peril is that, to me, if there's a very valid knock on the book, it's that at some point the book falls into a rhythm that becomes terrible thing happens, he fixes it, terrible thing that happens, he fixes it. And after a certain number of rounds of that, you get a little bit eager for the parts that are going to start to move the story forward more. But in the book, there are probably literally 8 times as many crises that he has to handle. To give one example that I don't think it's a spoiler or something that doesn't happen out of one of these many things, but there's a point where he's traversing a long distance fairly late in the story, where in the book he rolls the rover and it's a fairly big deal. He tips over and it becomes a big deal that he rolled the rover. As I was watching the movie, I thought, oh, this is the part where he rolls the rover. But I think very wisely, a lot of those things are taken out. They leave in, if you go through the movie and you see kind of the most catastrophic things that happen to him that he has to fix, I think they're the same most catastrophic things from the book, but it's not all in there.
Right. Well, the problem that Drew Goddard, the screenwriter, has that Andy Weir did not have is that the story unfolds over the course of about a year and a half.
Right.
And to make that amount of time pass in 2.5 hours, obviously difficult.
But one advantage that they have, and one thing that I mean, this is true of Gravity as well, but like, this is one of the benefits of fiction itself. We see so many pulled from real life. We see so many biopics. We see so many, you know, like stories that actually happened, where you have to shoehorn in unsatisfying things that happen in life. And one of the advantages that they have in this movie, that a lot of these movies we talk about don't, is they can compress it and you're not necessarily sitting there like, why didn't he roll the rover?
Right. Yeah. The other thing that I do want to talk about a little bit is this sprawling cast in this movie, because the guy that I saw the movie with, we walked out and he was immediately, has also read the book, and he was immediately sort of rattling off the way that they changed a lot of these characters. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's interesting is that they changed what either is stated to be or might reasonably be inferred to be the ethnic background of some of these characters in order to fit the actors that they had picked. And one of the things that's interesting about it is they're not all in the direction of making a character of color into a white person, right. which is all too often what you get. But for example, the character that's played by Chiwetel Ejiofor in the movie is pretty emphatically an Indian guy in the book. And there's a suggestion in the movie, he says, my father was Hindu and my mother is Baptist. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to suggest a kind of different background for him. But it's interesting to think, like, in the book, his name is Venkat Kapoor, and in the movie, it becomes Vincent Kapoor. Yeah, right. And they do kind of play around with that. And my friend asked about Mindy Park, who I think in the book, he assumed, I can't remember if they specifically say, but he assumed that perhaps that was a young Asian woman. And in the movie, she is a young white woman.
Yeah. I was trying to remember if the character played by Donald Glover in the film is identified by his background in the book. And I don't think he is.
I don't think they say. And there's obviously nothing wrong with doing that at all. And in fact, it's sort of refreshing to say if they don't say one way or the other, it can be anybody. But it's interesting in some of these cases that some of the ones that were the most noticeable in the book, like a markedly Indian person, which maybe I noticed that because in the book, they read that character with a bit of an accent in the audiobook. It's just sort of interesting to me that they did, because we should mention, you know, Matt Damon, but also Jessica Chastain, who plays the captain of the ship, Kristen Wiig, who works at NASA, Jeff Daniels, who works at NASA, Chiwetel Ejiofor, as I said, other astronauts, Michael Pena and Kate Mara and mission command dude Sean Bean and Sebastian Stan on the spaceship during the making of an Iron Man joke. Donald Glover, who you mentioned, a British actor named Benedict Wong, who I think is really funny in this movie in a kind of a small part.
He's the JPL team leader.
And then Mackenzie Davis, who plays Mindy Park, who I knew from the Daniel Radcliffe, Zoe Kazan romantic comedy, The F Word / What If, in which she's actually very funny. And I knew a couple people who had picked her out in a kind of a small part in that movie. I don't necessarily think she has a ton to do in this movie, but I'm always happy to see her.
Now, speaking of the F Word, that's a segue for you.
Yeah.
This movie doles out its F-bombs so carefully.
Because it's PG-13.
Right, but they do speak aloud two of them, which I thought was one more than you usually get in a PG-13.
I don't know.
But then once they have used up their allotment, they have to do all sorts of creative things.
Like
you see him shot from an airless place and see him mouthing the word. There are dashes where there probably wouldn't be dashes in
Britain. I got to say, my favorite one is when it's just a close-up of Jeff Daniels playing the administrator of NASA. We just see his face when Watney, speaking to the entire world, is, you know, speaking his feelings at having found out that the crew of the Hermes, his fellows, have not been told yet that he's survived. And we don't hear what he says, but we see the guy who's responsible
sort of
to answering for him react to what he says.
And I sat down the row at the movies from a probably 11 or 12 year old kid who was turning to his dad saying, "What does he say? What did he say?" And you could kind of sense the dad being like, "It's okay." Yeah.
So, Chris, briefly, how does this fit into Ridley Scott's oeuvre? You know, because if you had asked me who this guy was as a director in the era of Blade Runner and Alien, I would have said, "I know who this guy is." And then he's gone so far that he almost has become, I don't want to say a journeyman director, because that seems like it's a dig, but really a versatile director who doesn't impose a style onto the... I didn't detect any Ridley Scottiness.
It is harder and harder to pin him as an auteur, you know, this late in his career. I mean, having made Gladiator and Black Hawk Down and a lot of really poorly received movies, too. I mean, the guy... is just super prolific and just seems, you know, not, you know, he's not one of these guys like Kubrick or, you know, somebody where they're going to make a movie every 8 years. Well, he's just like, well, that one didn't work, on to the next.
He's also more script dependent, I think, than a lot of directors. Yeah. He doesn't necessarily put an authorial stamp on the scripts. He's often working with other people's scripts, and so he's at the mercy of that.
I was positive on this movie, and I think I liked it even more, I think, than I would have if I had just seen it on a weekend at a theater, because I originally saw it in Toronto, where it's surrounded by such heaviness and such like important, sad, often slow and ponderous movies, all of which are great things, right? But when you've been doing that for a couple days and then you cruise into the theater and it's this, and it's Matt Damon kind of as, I don't know, botany god, as he calls himself, space pirate.
Swamp Thing.
Yeah. Swamp Thing. That even more than probably if I had seen it for the first time. It's the equivalent of seeing it at the recliner theater without actually seeing it at the recliner theater.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have said this about this movie on this podcast before, so we don't need to belabor the point. But the fact that they don't bother to give this guy a backstory is such a gift.
Yes. Yep.
I think that the fact that they don't give him that backstory is not only valuable because it means you're not piling all that extra stuff on, but it allows the, I would say, emotion, Glenn might say sentimentality in some cases, it allows them to indulge it a little bit in other places, so that at those times when something works, you will see the cheering people at NASA. You can indulge in that when you're not also, when you don't also have a sobbing family and all that stuff. So you can kind of keep it focused on this community of scientists, which is really where their interest level is. When you don't load it up with all that stuff, you have the space for the things that feel important. And you can kind of, you can play around with those moments, I think I would argue, a little more freely than if you also had family stuff.
That makes sense.
Going on. Well, I think we basically like this movie, and perhaps you will like it too. Perhaps you will have seen it. It did make a lot of money. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. Tell us what you think of the movie. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit. You know, The Martian is a movie about a scientist hard at work trying to solve problems. We're going to talk a little bit about other workmanlike people in stories and how they do their jobs and get things done and how you learn about the details. So don't go away.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message comes from Blue Apron, the new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm fresh ingredients are perfectly portioned and come with an easy to follow recipe card, so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like eggplant, poblano, and gypsy pepper tostadas. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/pop to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/pop.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we talked about The Martian, in which you learn a lot about how you might try to survive on Mars if you were a highly trained scientist. So we thought that we would broaden out and talk a little bit about some of the other stories, whether they're books or movies or TV shows, that show you a little bit about the way that people do their jobs. And I will mention first that I threw this question out on Twitter to try to gather some responses. I certainly cannot list all of them, but some of the ones that I thought were very interesting. Nate DiMeo, a podcast host of some renown, immediately came back with one that I was not expecting, which was Moby Dick.
I have that written down.
Do you really? Good for you.
Like my main example.
Good for you. Then why don't you talk about Moby
Dick?
Well, Moby Dick.
No, I wanted to talk about the fact that I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage with this topic, because I think that if you are really going to go into great detail about the process, the way that The Martian does, I think very successfully, you need to give yourself many opportunities to digress. And the best medium in which to do that is fiction, and particularly books. And we have talked on this show before that I'm not super duper well read, but the first example that sprung to my mind was Moby Dick, which has these long gas bag digressions about like the intricacies of whaling.
Who's that
sure
by?
Does.
Yeah, say the title again.
Moby Dick.
Oh. Okay.
Herman Melville.
He doesn't know it's
No, it's Herman Melville. What are you jerks?
I'm just kidding.
The This isn't make fun of Steven for being ignorant. That is not this. That is not this topic.
I'm just kidding.
Really. We would relegate that to a small batch. But Moby Dick is a perfect example of a book that goes into tremendous detail, and I think is worse for it. Right? Like it does not lend itself to a propulsive plot. To stop and tell you how the whaling industry.
But that wasn't the interest of fiction of the time. Just propulsive plot. It was more about immersion, and it was more about saying, "I went on this experience. Here's what it is. Here. Let me put you in the head of this." It was to get people out of their humdrum lives
into
a humdrum with a lot more whale stabbing.
There was no TV then, you'll remember. Mm-hmm. So in order to be transported, instead of just watching a documentary on your television.
Or be told a story.
You need a chapter on rendering.
You need a chapter on rendering. And
in any story,
chapter
really.
on the shape of whale skulls,
yep.
I believe there is
mm-hmm.
one.
Because
I have read that book. Mm-hmm. I have read that book. Yes, I did. Mm. Boy, yeah, Moby Dick. What I loved about that is his other answer, WKRP. I was like, that's a good pairing right there.
That is a good pairing.
How about you, Glenn? Do you like one?
I know I've talked about on the show how I am a process nerd and I love to be shown how things work, but I couldn't come up with a single fiction book. It was tough for me to kind of, I know I've talked about them before on the show, but I can't. I came up with nothing but reality television. I came up with Project Runway, Top Chef.
Don't make me sorry. I suggested this topic.
You came up with reality television and I came up with a book.
I know.
All right.
Iron Chef, pretty much all the chefs.
Yeah.
RuPaul's Drag Race, how to. Mm-hmm. Mythbusters, they show you how
definitely.
They bust a myth, but they also show you how they build the thing, the apparatus that mm-hmm. busts the myth. Project Greenlight, what not to wear. If you have this body shape, do this. And all of HGTV. HGTV exists to do exactly this. Procedural shows like Law & Order is about, it starts here and it goes here. Columbo kind of dismantles the mystery story by showing you, here's how they did the murder, and here's how it gets picked apart piece by piece by the detective. That's kind of what I kept coming away from, is just these things that show you how you get from point A to point B.
How important in any of these things is any level of accuracy? Because when you talk about Law & Order, the interesting thing about Law & Order is Law & Order is one of the first lawyer shows that I remember seeing that actually addressed things like motion practice, right? Mm-hmm. That as a lawyer, you file a lot of motions. You file motions to keep evidence out. Then you got to go have a hearing. Then you got to file another motion. And then eventually you go to trial. And during the trial, you got to worry a lot about kind of what's happening and the jurors and all this stuff. So it is a process thing in that way. At the same time, it also is fond of the completely fictitious version of what closing arguments are, which is so fundamental to its rhythm. But that idea that a closing argument is where a lawyer gets up and speaks from the heart for 60 seconds is not at all what closing arguments are. Closing arguments are actually a very meticulous reciting of everything that you've just heard. Yeah. And it is the building of the wall that will eventually be your wall of certainty that the lawyer who's giving the speech is right. So on the one hand, they get into all this stuff, these kind of interlocutory appeals and things that kind of only lawyers care about. But then they kind of let you down at the end with the grandiosity of trial, which is not at all accurate. So does it matter if they're getting everything wrong or do they just have to give you certain insights?
It goes back to the difference between plausibility and believability. Plausible, yes, it needs to be. We need to think, oh, that could happen, but we need to believe it happens. And they do that by making you feel more, by having the big heartfelt speech. Burn Notice, a show to fold your laundry by, perfectly fine show. The conceit of it was he would be narrating and telling you all this stuff about spycraft, how to, if you're in this situation, do this. MacGyver famously is theoretically a how-to show, but they always leave one thing out so the children aren't blowing themselves up. MacGruber, for example, same thing. If you remember the beginning of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he tells you how to get out of school by licking your palms, it's like a little tiny thing thrown out there. Any heist movie, which I'm sure Chris has more thoughts on, and there's a difference between how-to and behind the scenes, but they're related. And, you know, if you watch, for example, as I have, the entirety of the special features for Lord of the Rings, the extended edition,
if you watch them in the right order,
you get not just behind the scenes.
Well, tell us what the right order is.
But
let's do 4 minutes on the correct order.
Oh, there's a button. You can just play all, and it will unspool from conception to finished product, and, you know, it'll 12 hours later. But
what happens if you watch them in the wrong order?
Well, you'll get confused, and you'll just get these little piecemeal things. But you'll also meet the best part of the special features, as I've talked about on the show before, mm-hmm. is that you meet
Richard Taylor, who is the head of Weta Workshop,
which is the prop department for them. And you see him, he's the ultimate nerd, and he is just so proud of what his people are doing, because he comes up and he says,
this, of course, is Gandalf's sword, Glamdring, the foe hammer.
And I could just listen to that guy all day.
I could listen to you channel that guy all day.
But I don't have anything else. I don't have...
No, you listed like 40 things.
I know, but I don't have fiction. I don't have books.
I don't have 41 things.
Yeah. No, I mean, I did bring a couple others.
Absolutely.
The adaptation, I think, is a very flawed movie. It's a little more uneven than its reputation shows. But Charlie Kaufman, who wrote that movie, spends a lot of time trying to dig into the process of writing, in many ways do feel true to what it's like when you were sitting there trying to get something out of your head and onto the page.
Yeah, having taken that Robert McKee 3-day screenwriting course, I was like, is this Kaufman just kind of mocking the whole thing? Or
kind of.
I think so.
Yeah, kind of. But there is a lot of the process of writing in that movie. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is, I don't know for sure that I can do the Heimlich maneuver, mm-hmm. but I feel like I can. And isn't that what's important?
Jeez. Well, I think one of the things that this got me thinking about was that there are certain professions that I think come up a lot, particularly on television and in movies, because they tend to be part of plots that people want to tell, right? So not just your cops and lawyers, but also your journalists, mm-hmm. which takes us back to something that we have talked about on this show before, that the lovely Audie Cornish has talked about on this show before, which is women journalists in movies and television always sleeping with the person that they're writing about. Pretty much always. Mm. I'm just going to say 99 times out of 100. So I think it's hard to find really good pieces about journalism, with a couple of exceptions that kind of people come back to over and over again, some of which are based on real stories, right? Like, people will cite All the President's Men because you see a lot of the reporting and you see the going from person to person, and you see the kind of assembling of a story and trying to get people to talk to you, get people to go on the record. You try. So there's that. And then there's something like broadcast news, which for me, I've never worked in television news, but I have worked in radio news. And so the beginning of broadcast news, all the business about rushing through the thing with the tape and all that rings reasonably true to me. They really do work on that kind of time margin. I suspect they did even more when they really had to move physical tapes around so much. Like, movies about politics, I think, are almost never accurate or really believable to me. And so when you see one, like we talked about this when we talked about Show Me a Hero, that its view of local politics to me rang relatively true. How about you, Chris?
Okay, well, why don't we hear a clip?
You know, you ought to take a look at the statistics on suicide sometime. You might learn a little something about the insurance business.
Mr. Keyes, I was raised in the insurance business.
Yeah, in the front office. Come now, you've never read an actuarial table in your life, have you? Why, they got 10 volumes on suicide alone. Suicide by race, by color, by occupation, by sex, by seasons of the year, by time of day. Suicide, how committed? By poisons, by firearms, by drowning, by leaps. Suicide by poison, subdivided by types of poison, such as corrosive, irritant, systemic, gaseous, narcotic, alkaloid, protein, and so forth. Suicide by leaps, subdivided by leaps from high places, under the wheels of trains, under the wheels of trucks, under the feet of horses, from steamboats. But Mr. Norton, of all the cases on record, there's not one single case of suicide by leap from the rear end of a moving train. And you know how fast that train was going at the point where the body was found? 15 miles an hour. Now, how can anybody jump off a slow-moving train like that with any kind of expectation that he would kill himself? No, no soap, Mr. Norton. We're sunk, and we'll have to pay through the nose, and you know it.
This is Double Indemnity, Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler adapting a novel by James N. Cain, notable mainly for having more or less invented film noir. I think that we get two how-tos here. We get a how-to of how the insurance business works.
Right.
And then how to defraud the insurance industry. The murder. I'm suggesting this topic, I immediately painted myself into a corner because I couldn't think of any good examples. I wanted to distinguish between a how-to and a procedural because the procedure never changes, right? Law and order, the format is the same. The particulars differ from week to week. But then I realized that could almost be the definition of any genre, mm-hmm. The format is static. I think that this does speak to, like, we really like to have a process explained to us and be told how something is supposed to work and then see how it goes wrong. And I could not think of a better example of that than this murder plot in Double Indemnity, where even though this is wrongdoing, this is mortal sin, we still feel invested and we start to sweat when it appears that Fred McMurray is going to be found out.
Yeah.
You may know the film Zero Effect. This is written and directed by Jake Kasdan, son of Lawrence Kasdan, who, of course, made Body Heat, among other more commercial films, remake of Double Indemnity. But he goes on to do Freaks and Geeks after this. Mm-hmm. Zero Effect precedes the TV show Monk, I want to say, because it is about a dysfunctional, mentally ill, but brilliant private detective, played by your guy, Bill Pullman.
Oh, sure.
And his suffering assistant, played by Ben Stiller. But there's a lot of how to be a private detective in this movie, which is sort of, I think, about 1998, quirky mix of tones. I remember very specifically, though I could not find a clip, he explains how you follow someone without being spotted.
Oh, sure.
A lot of bits in that.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that film and television and radio get wrong about writing is, you know, something like The Basketball Diary, something like Moulin Rouge. These scenes of the writer sitting in front of their typewriter, tappity-tappity-tappity-tap, as if that's interesting to watch, which it is not, in a rush of inspiration. So that's what the view of what writing is. There's not nearly enough alphabetizing your spice rack.
Right.
Fluffing pillows.
Yeah. Right.
Folding laundry.
Pacing.
Self-abuse. There's not nearly enough of any of that stuff just to kind of make it seem remotely believable, because it is all about this brilliant, you know, with the words floating through the air in front of you.
Right.
That's just not the way
I would submit, though, that that is true of many, 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 many professions, and the way they are depicted is, I think most professions have a gigantic element of boredom to them.
Yeah.
You know, you're not necessarily going to show, like, for example, a movie about a stakeout isn't necessarily going to have, like, it's not 86 hours long, so you're not seeing as much of the waiting around as there
you
probably
have not
is.
Seen my 86-hour experimental film, The Stakeout.
Yes. Andy Warhol's Lethal Weapon is really a classic example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's even true. I don't think there's any question that that's even true of professions people think of as intrinsically exciting, like being a police officer or
the paperwork alone.
Certainly, sure. An attorney, in which you spend a lot of time on the phone with other attorneys, which is the most boring thing you can do in the entire world. Which is one of the reasons I don't do it anymore.
I remember a cop telling me that Barney Miller was actually a lot more realistic of his day job, basically filling out paperwork.
Yeah.
Filling out paperwork. Hill Street Blues, the same thing.
Yeah, well, somebody has to. I had a bunch of people mention certainly lots of documentaries to me on Twitter when I threw this out there. Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Sure.
I would mention the September issue, which is about Anna Wintour, which is completely fascinating. I thought it was completely fascinating.
Yep. The Perfect Candidate is a wonderful ground-level political movie.
I think Frederick Wiseman's like entire career. I mean, he's made like 40 movies that are about people's jobs, more or less.
Perfect Candidate is one.
The War Room is another.
The War Room is another. Bill Cunningham, New York, which we've talked about on this show before, is wonderful and is about a working person and the way he goes about doing what he does. I think there are a ton of documentaries that are worth mentioning. The lovely Rhea Butcher mentioned Bull Durham, which I thought was which I thought was a good.
I love that movie.
I love that movie too. 6 Feet Under. It won a lovely, I thought, very charming vote for my cousin Vinny from somebody who said, we're taught that movie by a litigation professor, who said it's a good story about advocacy and cross-examination. Huh. And I thought, fair enough. A vote for Call the Midwife. Votes for lots and lots and lots of things. And so if you go back and find that tweet in my timeline, you can find all the replies and see what everybody said. There was a certain amount of fiction, but also lots and lots of nonfiction and documentary. So thanks for all your contributions if you contributed to that conversation. And feel free to send us more of your ideas about great TikToks and how-tos and that sort of thing. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. We will be right back.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Be sure to check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Every week, Jesse interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
A wonderful invention from the most recent episode of Last Week with John Oliver. I don't know how many of you've seen it. He did a segment about the much discussed People app, which supposedly, if it ends up happening, would let you rate people whether they want
to. There's some indication today they're backpedaling.
I'm assuming that's not going to happen. But anyway, it's like Yelp, but for people. Terrible, terrible idea. John Oliver did a segment about it in which he pitched two possible products. One of them was just a joke thing called Peeble, in which you can be rated by actor and Renaissance man Mario Van Peebles, where you would send him a photo and he would give you a certain number of stars. And they, of course, got Van Peebles to do that. The other is a genuinely useful and wonderful website that I have been using all day long. It is called screamintothevoid.com. It's just a very simple screen. It says Scream Into the Void. And then there's a little bar that says type your feelings here. And you just type whatever you want into it. Type like a confession or something angry. They had a joke about Meryl Streep that they type in. And then you hit scream and it goes, bah! As your deepest, darkest thought, you see it plunge into a black hole and disappear. Like, first of all, it's a lovely little piece of commentary, but it is also a very useful little primal scream exercise. Like, I was stressed out today and actually just typed a bunch of stuff and sent it down into the void. So screamintothevoid.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. Eugene Merman's Netflix special came out this summer. It's called Vegan on His Way to the Complaint Store. And I think this guy's at the top of his game. He does the observational stuff from his very unique perspective. He does something he's been doing since he started. I saw him many years ago, and he was doing this show-and-tell shtick, where he takes actual letters, he takes paintings, he takes Facebook posts he's written, and he just reads them out. That's at one end of the spectrum, very prepared. Very, very prepared. The other end of this special, he is also doing a lot of crowd work. He's basically just stopping the show dead to say, any questions? And he answers them very wittily and very funnily. So that is Vegan on His Way to the Complaint Store on Netflix, Eugene Merman's special. This is number two. Jess, hit me once.
The Reynolds pamphlet. Have you read this? Alexander Hamilton had a torrid affair, and he wrote it down right there. Charge against me is a connection with one James Reynolds for purposes of improper speculation.
Okay, that obviously is from the cast album of Hamilton, the Broadway musical, which is lighting up the Great White Way even as we speak. It came out a couple weeks ago, and I want to be clear. I haven't seen this yet. I've only listened to the cast album several times. And by the rate that tickets are selling and being priced, it probably won't happen. I won't see it until 2019 or so.
Yeah.
Conservatively. What I'm missing, obviously, from just listening to it is this tableau of seeing your American history with its very, very white founding fathers portrayed by a largely people of color cast. But I do get all of the story because, of course, this is all rapped or sung. That's why there's 46 songs on this cast album. So it's no book, all lyrics. And it makes sense. I mean, for decades, before rock and roll came along, we got a lot of our popular music from Broadway. Now, and there have been rock musicals before, and there are hip-hop musicals before, but now it makes sense that what's popular outside the Broadway community is now feeding itself back into the Broadway community. I think it's not a coincidence that the last time there was a crossover hit outside that kind of had this appeal beyond, that got this amazing buzz, was The Book of Mormon, which also took something from outside the Broadway community, which was a very South Park sensibility, and grafted it onto the bones of an old Broadway musical. And that's to say that there's a lot of rap in this, there's a lot of hip-hop, there's a lot of R&B, but there is a note of old Broadway, as Chris will attest. None other than Jonathan Groff comes out three times to sing the same song, the same melody, with slightly different lyrics, accompanied by, just to put an old Broadway face on it, a harpsichord, just to kind of show you how old school this really gets. The ambition of this show is real. There's not a trace of irony in anything I'm hearing. The reason I think it's working is because it really risks something. It risks what we've talked about before on the show, fiasco, in a very real way. And the reason I chose that particular clip is because I think there are times listening to this that the fiasco it could have been comes dangerously close to the surface, so close you can see its periscope. If you got a sense that there was anything insincere here, or it was trying too hard, or was holding itself back, you might emerge from the theater that night thinking, calm down, Schoolhouse Rock. I get what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
But because this is so sincere, and because it is about something. It's about the immigrant experience. It's also really about ambition in a real way, so it kind of ties in together, that I think, and I'm going way on a limb here, we're going to be talking about this in Tony season.
Yeah. Go figure.
This thing out is on gonna, a limb, Glenn Will.
That's right. That's my bold prediction. But that is, of course, Hamilton, which has been talked about on the show before, but I'm talking about it again because this cast album is amazing.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
All right. Can we hear number three?
Dream, baby, dream. Come on and dream, baby, dream. Come on and dream, baby, dream. Keep a fire burning. You gotta keep a light burning. Come on and keep the fire burning.
So what we're hearing, this is an archival release of a Bruce Springsteen concert from about 10 years ago. He suddenly, in the last year, has been making available official high-quality recordings for relatively inexpensive download from his website. And I am like just the right age where I can remember, you know, hunting out Don't Call Them Bootlegs at specialty CD stores where you would have to ask for them in coded language. Do you sell rare live imports? And they would cost about twice what a normal legal CD would cost. And this is, you know, part of this is just the ongoing story of the internet making everything that you ever wanted instantly available. I really appreciated this show. This was a tour that I saw, a solo, primarily acoustic tour.
Yeah, I saw this tour.
Yeah, where, you know, there was always a few people in the house who didn't understand that they were not seeing the E Street Band and they wanted to rock out and they were, you know, checking out after a couple songs. But I always like this format, particularly with an artist who has a, you know, a long and varied catalog and that is very identified in the public imagination with a particular style. And the opportunity for curation in the set list that a format like this provides, where you are absolved of the requirement that you rock the hits a little bit and you can go a little bit deeper, you can surprise people. This particular show, which was in Columbus, Ohio in July 2005, just has a lot of curveballs, a lot of weird covers. What we're hearing right now is a cover of the song Dream Baby Dream by Suicide, which is how he was closing the show each night on this tour. It was my introduction to this song. And that is what is making me happy this week.
Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. Okay, before I get to my normal run of happy for this week, we are excited to tell you that Barry Hardiman, well known to PCHH listeners, is working on a book project, and it is sort of adjacent to what we do on this show. And it is safe to say she is starting with a bang.
Yeah.
On November 2nd, you're going to get to hear her interview the author, Robert Galbraith, about the new book, Career of Evil, mm-hmm. in connection with a new book club that she's going to be working on. Mm-hmm. Now, you may also know that Robert Galbraith is a pseudonym used by J.K. Rowling. So
what?
I know who you may know for writing some books with wizards in them.
I've heard of her.
Yes. So again, coming November 2nd, our own Barry Hardiman is kicking off a new project by interviewing Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling. You will not want to miss that, and you will get it right here in your Pop Culture Happy Hour feed. Now, I was originally coming up a little bit short on things making me happy this week because I left the house more than usual this week, and that's very hard on my choosing of things to make me happy that anyone else can actually appreciate. But I did come up with a couple things. First of all, we had a listener on Twitter who goes by the name Charlie the Summoner, who sent us a photo of himself and his daughter cosplaying as Lockjaw and Ms. Marvel.
Yep.
It's pretty awesome.
It really is.
It's pretty great. And it was one of those things that you look at and you just think, all these people are going to do awesome.
Uh-huh.
Like, because it's fantastic. It made me very, very happy. That's one thing. Also, cleaned off my desk. Feeling pretty good about that. You might not think that that's important from a pop culture standpoint, but if you want me to be able to talk to you about things, I have to unbury myself from those things. So that's very important. But then I did actually think of something that I can share with you all, which is that on Saturday night, I watched the unauthorized Lifetime movie about Beverly Hills 90210. You know, Lifetime has started doing these unauthorized stories. They did one about Saved by the Bell. The day after this episode drops, they're doing one about Melrose Place. They're terrible. from any kind of objective standpoint, they're extremely bad. What you get is a bunch of people who are cast to try to act like old actors of the past. And usually you don't get any particularly valuable information, not that there necessarily is any, but you don't usually learn a whole lot. It's mostly an opportunity to sit on Twitter or the other social media environment of your choice and discuss how bad they are or how the wardrobe is. And that has really been what I have enjoyed the most about this one. This one led to, unsurprisingly, a special episode of one of my favorite podcasts, the Again With This podcast, which has been covering episodes of actual 90210 out of previously.tv, but also covered this. Also a recap from the Fug Girls, who have a 64-slide slideshow running down everything that happens in this movie. It's really so bad, and I sort of enjoyed it. It takes me back to my old Television Without Pity days when I recapped both a behind-the-scenes story of Three's Company and a movie about the lifetime history of Donald Trump.
Yep.
So I have some experience in this genre, and I can tell you these are bad. So. But enjoying their badness has been making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Chris at CT Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.